You are listening to The Pulse, Rod Murray's e-learning tech podcast, number 115.
Hi, this is Rod Murray. Welcome back to my podcast. That was a little teaser from a piece called Something About Eve by a group called Falling You. As you might note, it's sort of an ethereal, ambient, New Age music piece. Don't forget, you can listen to the full piece at the end of my podcast. Today I have the privilege of interviewing Dr. Kenneth Hartman, who's formerly the president of Drexel University Online, or Drexel eLearning, if you will, and currently a senior fellow at EduVentures. He has a tremendous amount of experience in higher education, especially online. The Drexel program is probably one of the most successful online systems that I'm aware of. We discuss the future of higher education, especially around the issue of online, some of the trends, what higher educations will need to do in order to survive, and some of the ongoing controversy, changes in accreditation, MOOCs, etc. In fact, Ken uses the metaphor of riding down the highway and seeing a bridge out sign, and some schools are ignoring it and zipping right past the exits. So stay tuned, listen to my interview, and let me know what you think. Ken, thanks a lot for joining me today on my podcast. I told my audience a little bit about you, but why don't you give me a quick tour of where you've been and how you got into this business?
Sure. Thanks, Rod, again, for spending a couple of minutes with me. I've been in higher education now for just over 30 years, came up through the ranks, assistant professor, associate professor, department chair, et cetera. And about 10 years ago, and then also along the way had some other great opportunities to serve in various educational capacities, including as an executive with the college board. But about 10 years ago, got an offer to go much deeper into the online world and was given an offer to come to Drexel University Online, which at that time was very, very small. Now it's one of the largest online degree programs, initially as, in essence, the chief academic officer, and then rising through the ranks to become president of the organization. Drexel University Online is unique in that it is a for-profit subsidiary of Drexel University, which, of course, is a big, massive Research One institution with a law school and a medical school. When I left there just about a year ago, Drexel University Online had over 8,000 students, all adults, of course, in their program, over 100 degree programs. And we were generating somewhere around $75 million a year in tuition revenue. So it's a very, very big program. And but after 9 years, it was time to move on to pursue other activities. And today, as you indicated, I am helping as a consultant and a senior fellow with EduVentures.
Yeah, and I guess the way we met was really around our use of Blackboard and helping to pull together a Philadelphia area Blackboard users group, and then giving you a little bit of help really with the National Distance Learning Day.
I started that several years ago to try and gain greater awareness of online learning, and that is in partnership with USDLA, United States Distance Learning Association. But, you know, when we started this business not that long ago, basically all you needed to do was to put a few courses up online, have an LMS, some marketing dollars, and you're off and running. And wow, what a difference a decade has made.
That's right. That's right. In fact, today I guess we're talking a little bit about, sort of the future of higher education, and you're well-versed in this. I'm interested to hear your thoughts about the growth of online and what you might say about MOOCs. Every day we see another article about MOOCs. Are they good or bad? And how about, first of all, how about the growth of online? I know you have your finger on that.
Yeah, well, you know, we've seen, obviously, online growth, particularly, again, we're talking about adult learners, grow immensely over the last 10 years. But all reports, including the reports EdgeVentures has issued, indicate a flattening of that. On the traditional age side, we have seen a tremendous growth in the number of traditional age students taking one or more courses, not in a degree program. But by the same token, you see a decrease in the number of 18-year-olds graduating from high school. So I think that the big days of institutions starting a program and going from, you know, 100 students to 8,000 students in 5 or 6 years, I think those days are over with for now. Higher education, as you know, is going through an awful lot of change right now. We have a lot of factors, not the least of which is the economy. But clearly, as an industry, we are facing some unprecedented headwinds. And I think that will no doubt impact online learning as well. I think we, as an industry, we are moving from what I mentioned before, where an institution could grab an LMS, find a few willing professors to throw a few talking PowerPoints up and call it a course, to an industry where online learning has pretty much been commoditized. And the future, I believe, in online learning will be in the differentiation that can be made and the quality that institutions are going to be able to produce along with the outcomes. So the old days of saying that our online program is convenient 24/7, everybody's saying that. I think the future is going to be those, for those institutions that are truly going to not just say they have a quality online program, but are going to be able to really introduce innovative pedagogical approaches and be able to demonstrate outcomes to not just traditional learners, but I would say increasingly the traditional 18-year-old kids who are going to be looking for a good hybrid experience.
One of the roadblocks, at least that in my experience, is that the departments of education, whether they be at the state level or the national level, doesn't seem to be keeping up with this technology, and maybe in terms of accreditation, you know, and how you make equivalencies between credits on the ground or online. Do you see that as changing, or how's that affecting this path?
Clearly, we're starting to see a few new movements. For example, the recent announcement from Southern New Hampshire University, whereby Title IV funding will be able to be used for outcomes-based or competency-based degree programs. I think that's going to be, you know, outcomes-based competency-based programs are not new. Schools like Excelsior College in New York State have been doing that for years. It was just only a cash business. You couldn't use Title IV dollars for it. And again, primarily an adult learner option. I mean, most 18-year-old kids, including my 22-year-old and my 19-year-old, don't really have competencies that be at that age yet, because they have not worked outside of, you know, they haven't worked. So some of these new models, I think, will continue to grow within the adult learning population. I think what will be the game changer in the traditional age, 18-year-old, is when the accreditation agencies, and I argue the federal government as well, begin to challenge some of the basic fundamental requirements of what constitutes a bachelor's degree in this country, to include the 120 semester hours. I think that the three-year bachelor's degree, the 90-semester bachelor's degree, is coming. I don't know who's going to have it, where it's going to happen, but the pressure that is now coming from the public, as well as the support it's getting from both parties, both the donkeys and the elephants, are hearing from their constituents that the cost of higher education is out of control. And, you know, I would argue, as an educator, that defending a four-year degree program, 120 semesters, is in fact indefensible. There is no evidence to suggest that 4 years versus, for example, the three-year British model is defensible. So I see some changes being forced on regional accreditation agencies, either by the federal government or by legislatures, to make some of these really fundamental changes in what we call a bachelor's degree.
It'll be interesting to see what that does to the business model. I was a bit surprised to hear President Obama coming out for law schools, reducing their programs to 2 years. And it does have the support of some pretty high-profile faculty in law. How do you think institutions, more traditional institutions, are going to adapt?
Yeah, I think that if they don't adapt, they're going to go out of business. I mean, with the exception of the nifty 50 and perhaps the top 100 institutions, all of them are struggling right now. In fact, there was a report that came out just yesterday, published in Inside Higher Education, a survey by the Gallup poll showing that 46% of admissions directors reported, quote, very concerned, unquote, about meeting their targets. And another 30% were, quote, modestly concerned, unquote. And I thought this is very telling. 29% of admissions directors admit they have recruited applicants after May 1st who had committed to other colleges, which is a violation of the NACAC good practices effort and guidelines. So we have this scattering around of colleges that are struggling right now. And I think you and I have talked before. I'm in the process of writing another essay, American Higher Ed Highway. And the metaphor here is that you're on this highway and you come across a sign that says bridge out 5 miles ahead, exit now. And you ignore it. And then 2 miles down the road, you see another sign that says bridge out 3 miles ahead, exit now. And then eventually you get a mile away and it says last exit, bridge out, exit now. Higher ed administrators and leaders in higher education are flying by these exits. A MOOC might have been one of those exits, but clearly the bridge is out. That's not going to change. It's just a question of when leaders within higher education recognize that the bridge is out. They should know that by all the indications that are out there and choose an exit, either the first exit, the second exit, or the third exit, because after that, well, you know what happens.
I was going to ask you what your take is on MOOCs. Are they good or bad? And granted, I'm sure there's a spectrum of quality. Do you think that's a good terminology? Do you think we're going to see many different flavors of MOOCs? And are they good or bad for the institutions?
I mean, I don't know if they're good or bad. I just know that for most institutions, it flies right in the face of their financial model. I mean, a school like Notre Dame University or the University of Delaware or any other institution that has large general ed courses like psychology and sociology, where you have 400, 500, or maybe even 1,000 students in that class, each paying, you know, $2,000 a class, cannot simply give those students a $65 credit option. As we all know, the model that we built in higher education is in large part built on these large classes. And if you're not in a large class, you're probably in a smaller class and paying really, really high tuition. So to give that away for $65, I just don't see that happening. I see MOOCs as being a good way for institutions to give, if you will, a free sample of the type of scholarship that's available, knowledge at their institution, perhaps as a marketing and admissions gimmick. But I don't see it as replacing what ultimately the consumer wants, which is a good quality, either online hybrid experience with a subject matter expert and some of the services and some of the relationship building that goes along with that. I just don't see it as a big player in higher education. I think there are other things like the 3-year degree program and other things that are going to be the disruptors in this industry. I don't think MOOCs are going to be that way. But again, I could be wrong.
In your experience, how have faculty responded to this idea that the bridge is out? I guess there are faculty that look at it different ways. Maybe the young faculty look at it differently from the older faculty. How do faculty respond to some of these ideas?
I don't think for the most part faculty have woken up yet to what we're truly facing. My experience after writing, and some people could say provocative type essays, my experience, my reaction from faculty is typically, well, Ken, that's true. We're facing tough economic times. And yes, we have high unemployment. And sure, the public doesn't appreciate the tuition increases that we've had over time. But we've experienced that all before. And we've been at war before and so forth. And my reaction is, well, that is true, but never all at one time. And that's the difference between what we're facing today in our world and certain industry than, say, 10, 15, or even 30 years ago when I started. So the secret is for college presidents to have the courage, and the provost to have the courage to tell the faculty the truth about what they're facing now and what they're likely to face in the future, and that it's time now to build a life raft. You may not have to use it, but in the event that the economic conditions that we face right now get much worse, and it's not going to take much for that to happen. All we have to do is see the euro collapse or, heaven forbid, an all-out war in the Middle East where oil prices skyrocket. It doesn't take much for that to happen. And all of a sudden, institutions are going to have a lot worse of predictions than what we read in the Inside Higher Education today about enrollment. So the secret is, when it comes to faculty, is to have the strong administrative leadership that tells them the truth and says, look, let's build that life raft. If we don't have to use it, then how much worse are we off? But in the event that we do have to use it, in the event that students can't afford our program here, we have this ability to offer a newer, perhaps better, hopefully better, but certainly less expensive educational product.
How much of this change in higher ed is driven by the departments of education? Are there any areas of the country that seem to be looking out for the future and maybe shifting more from the traditional credit base to more of an outcomes-based program?
Well, yeah. I mean, states, for example, Texas is moving along those lines. Florida is another state that's doing some interesting things with hybrid and online education. I think ultimately what you'd seen is in many of these states, the state legislatures are hearing from their constituents about the cost of the state universities in their system and demanding that the state universities come up with different models to make education more accessible and more affordable. The other piece that you're hearing more and more about, of course, is the return. And one of the things that I just got back from listening to a briefing on the Higher Education Reauthorization Act, and experts were saying at this event last week that the one thing that everybody in Washington is saying, and it's anyone's guess when this will, in fact, when higher education will be reauthorized. It could be a year, it could be a year, 2 years, it could be 3 years from now, but at some point it will be authorized. I think the last one was 10 years beyond the point of when it should have been authorized. But one of the things that they are saying that will be true is that much of the new federal regulations that have principally been targeted at the for-profit colleges, such as gainful employment and other of the big regulations, gainful employment, as well as the debt-to-income regulations. What everybody is saying is that in the new reauthorization, those regulations will be targeted not just at the for-profits, but at the nonprofits as well. And again, there are Democrats and Republicans both believe that the standards that they've asked the for-profits to live by should be the same standards that the nonprofits. So if you go to a state university, the state university should be held accountable for their graduates getting out and finding gainful employment. Now, you may disagree with that or you may agree with that. But the fact of the matter is there's a very good possibility that those regulations are coming to a nonprofit college near you. And so today is where these college leaders should be talking about that.
I know a lot of schools are trying to fill their enrollment with students that don't get a discount. Many of them perhaps are foreign students with, you know, some articulation agreements and so on. What's been the impact, do you think, of going that route?
Well, what's interesting is that the discount rate now is at 45%, which is an all-time high. And no business can afford and stay open when they have half off sale every single day of the week. So clearly this notion of taking from one and giving to another, at some point in time, that doesn't work. And we're starting to see that happening now. And you're reading in the Chronicle and other publications about institutions who have said, you know, we're no longer discounting. We're simply going to apply that lower level to everybody. So instead of giving a 45% discount, we're simply going to reduce tuition and not give out financial aid. I think you're going to see more of that. Initially, that's going to be a good marketing gimmick, but eventually it will have to be the same. Going to international students, what experts have told me is that we've gone through in India and China and Brazil what oftentimes is referred to as the grade A, if you will, international students, in other words, the children of diplomats and ambassadors who have a very strong command of the English language and have been immersed in Western culture, to a growing new middle class of students, the new rich in India and China and India, who don't have very strong English skills and who need some sort of cultural transition, but they have the ability to pay full freight. So you're starting to see new businesses and new refocusing on who these students are and how do you get them to your campus, and more importantly, help them with that transition, because otherwise they will simply fail and they will disrupt the classroom, as we're seeing now at some institutions, and professors complaining that the, for example, Chinese students who are coming over are sitting in the back of the room by themselves and unable to participate in classroom discussions because their language skills are so weak. So again, I think another example of a tipping point we are at in higher education.
Well, this doesn't sound very, very encouraging. Can you think of any bright spots? What's your best hope for how things are going to work out in the next few years?
As you know, I am an eternal optimist, and I've always said where there is a crisis, there is an opportunity. I see this as a time, a great time for higher education. We are seeing a plethora of new and exciting companies, for-profit, small upstarts that are coming to campuses with new tools and new methods for delivering instruction, for retention methods, for the use of technology, in ways that these young companies could never get over the great wall of higher education because of, well, the culture that felt that unless we invented it in our campus, it must not be any good. So I see this is a great time. We will have no choice. We will have to reformat, transform education. There will always be a spot, you know, again, for the nifty 50, and you want that traditional experience, that will be there. But we're going to see new modes of learning, new modes of technology to deliver that learning. And quite frankly, I believe better outcomes and certainly better measurable outcomes with what down the road with the technology that exists, whether it be computer adaptive assessment or some of the other things that are out there. I think once you let the innovation, America's unbridled and unlimited innovation, come into higher education, you're going to find a better learning, more robust learning, and truly what our economy needs to be competitive again. But if we cling on to the past and say all we need to do is tinker at the edges and bring in better talking PowerPoint slides, or maybe what we need to do is to have a little hybrid here and a little hybrid there, we are going to find ourselves once again at the last exit without a strategy. And the good news is that that's totally preventable at this point in time. 10 years from now, 5 years from now, not so sure.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, I like you, I am an optimist. I wake up every morning and read the my various blogs and journals, and I'm always excited about the latest technology and how it can help higher education, how it can help everybody with lifelong learning. So I think this is probably a good time as any to end on a very positive note. And I want to thank you very much for your time today and helping us to look down the road and see where we need to go. So again, Ken, thanks so much.
Rod, it's been a pleasure. Thanks very much.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Ken. Although the picture's kind of grim, I think we ended on an optimistic note. At least I'm very optimistic. You also see in my show notes a link to an article that Dr. Hartman wrote. It's in Inside Higher Ed, which he talks about some of the same issues. He calls it the no-wake syndrome, meaning awake from a boat. I guess we're switching from the highway metaphor to the boat metaphor, but some of the ideas are the same. So take a look at that as well. Stay tuned for the full song, Something About Eve. Until next time, have a great week.
That's it for today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to give Rod feedback. You can leave comments on his blog, send email to rod@rodspulsepodcast.com, or leave audio feedback on his comment line at 610-616-2199. The preceding audio commentary is the product of the author, Dr. Rodney Murray, and does not represent the official viewpoint of the University of the Sciences or any other institution or company.